Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get love in a better place. Pick up a little, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when I and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for Marcia Joyce, my sister, who started me on this crusade. And this book, and we have the author of The Crushing Depths here. And this book is really so good. It's fantastic. And Dani Petri is here, and she's going to tell us more about it. So good morning, and I'm so glad that you're here. This book was really interesting. It was quite different than most books that I've read recently.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And thank you so much for having me today. I'm really excited to spend the time with you and with your listeners.
Yeah, this book was interesting, and thank you for printing it out. I mean,
absolutely.
I was like, yeah, I know. I don't read digital, and I was like so excited that somebody sent me a book that I could actually see the font, which is great. So,
that's
what made
great.
You decide of all? You must have had to do research to do this. So, what made you decide to focus? This is on an oil rig and the death of one of the crew members. I think I've read in the last 10 years, about 10,000 books. My husband's keeping count. Seriously, no joke.
Oh, my
and,
goodness.
Yeah, that's me. And
he says
he keeps me out of the store shopping. Well, not any, you know, now you have Amazon to shop, so you don't need to worry about it.
Well,
so why an oil rig?
And
how did you create the first scene? Because that had to take research, too.
Yes. So I decided on the oil rig, and my husband and I had watched, we had seen it before, but we watched Deepwater Horizon, and I just found the, not necessarily the accident they had or, you know, the catastrophe that happened, but the way that they lived on the rig, it was just fascinating that these guys get flown out and they're out there for, you know, 3 weeks, a month, or whatever their shift is, flown back in, a new crew comes out. And I thought, that's got to be so strange, living out there on an oil rig. But I did not know much about it. So, especially, like you said, the opening scene where the guy dies. I was able to speak to two gentlemen. One, my husband knew through his work, and I don't remember how I got the other one. It must have been through a friend, but two guys who worked on rigs. One had literally been on rigs all over the world doing different things, and he was super helpful. And then the other gentleman had been pretty much set, I think, off the Gulf of Texas, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, like off the coast of Texas. And so he was talking a little bit more about life on it, you know, having been kind of a regular there. And then my husband has engineering in his background and production. And so he was able to help answer some of the other questions. So it definitely was, and I read, I've got books, I went online. It was a lot to put that together to try to be as accurate as possible.
You're very lucky because I do panel shows, and I've been trying to get a medical advisor to talk about the COVID virus, but I've gotten law enforcement and I've gotten journalists and stuff. We've done a whole lot, but you're lucky when you have somebody that can actually help you to write something or to write a book.
Very true. Very true.
To make
true.
It accurate, that's especially something like this. So smoking is bad enough, but on an oil rig? What are the dangers of smoking on an oil rig, especially this one? And this was a freak accident. This is really weird.
Yes, it is. So the dangers of smoking on an oil rig are high, obviously, because you have flammable gas lots of things that are flammable on the rig already, and you already have oxygen, and so you're basically just looking for that heat element, adding some heat to the oxygen and the gases in the air. And the thing is, the gases you can't see, and when they're pure, like when they're running them through the separator on an oil rig, they don't have that added smell. So, yeah, anywhere near an open flame or gas is a horrible thing to do. They do, I found out, and it was surprising to me, have smoking stations. They have areas where it's safe, apparently, and there's nothing around you where you're allowed to smoke because I guess these guys are, smokers that have been smoking for a long time, and for them to be out there 3 weeks without smoking is too hard. But, yeah, that could have easily – spread a lot faster, and it could have really caused tremendous problems and loss of life. So it's really, I even hesitate that they have a smoking area, to be honest, but they do.
So tell us about Reese Dawson and Mason Rogers' role. And they were sent to investigate, and they didn't look too happy to see each other. And we know why, but it's kind of weird when you have a relationship and then it doesn't. So how come you created that? That was tension at the beginning. That was really good.
Thank you. Yeah. So Reese Dawson and Mason Rogers basically had met in the past for a short time, for a few months, and were in a children's home together. Both have different reasons for why they were there. And they had a, friendship of sorts while they were there. And now he's back in her life, and she's not quite sure how to handle it. She had cared about him, throughout the years and thought about him, but there was that whole tension of, I haven't seen somebody in 10 years, and I know kind of how we were when you left, but how is it going to be as an adult relationship? And I think that them being sent out, the two of them alone, I think made her very nervous. And I honestly think that their boss, Noah, sent them on purpose, the two of them, because, he needs to know that they can work together. If they're part of the team, he needs to know they can work together.
I wasn't crazy about Noah to start with, but he grew on me eventually. She's the head of the Coast Guard Investigated Service Team. This proves people that I read the book. Seriously. What is their job? There's Reese, Mason, Emmy, Logan, and Caleb. Aha.
Yes.
So Caleb comes too, and he's not thrilled about this whole thing. So, what exactly are they supposed to do? They were sent to the members of the Dauntless, and they're sent to head to investigate the death. So, how did they go about it?
So they were sent to investigate the death. If there is a death at sea, the Coast Guard Investigative Service is called in. And they need to go and look at the evidence, interview everybody, transport the body back to the medical examiner. They're kind of the chain of custody. And so between what they are able to find around the crime scene, speak with people, the interviews, get an overall feel, and then transport the body back to the ME, they're able to look at factors and decide if they feel foul play was at all involved. And if it is, then they have to go deeper into it. If they look at it and say, no, it was definitely an accident, the ME signs off it was an accident, then they wouldn't have to do anything else. But there's indications foul play was involved. They are waiting to have that confirmed based on one of the experts who needs to come out and determine that for sure based on some of the equipment that it was that failed, that it was not a natural fail of equipment. It was something that had been set up ahead of time.
Well, they're not worried. They're not done with killing people. So you'd sabotage it. That made me really think, okay, I'm not going in a helicopter ever again, or a plane, or anywhere else, or anywhere again. I was like, I did have an experience like that. That's why. When I had to go with my mom to California, we hired a Learjet for $12,900. My brother paid for this insanity, and because they didn't want us to go because she was very sick with COPD and blood clot, whatever.
Yeah.
So we're going to the University of California in San Diego, and we got this Learjet. I'm the one that goes there, and my mother and this strange three guys, and the plane almost crashed. Because we got up in the air, and in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they had a forced land. Then they had a forced land again, and there was something wrong with the steering.
God.
So I knew, as I'm sitting there saying, I felt like I was reliving this, except that being the big, you know, I think that was the first time in my life I actually, you know, went crazy. And the guy comes off a different Learjet, a blue one, and I said to him, and he's in a suit, I said, who are you? I'm the president of Beechcraft Airlines. I said, and whose jet is that? He said, mine. I said, no, it's mine. Coming back. And I took it.
Good for you.
I said, for $12,900, I'm taking your jet. Yeah, we did. So
hilarious.
When you wrote this scene, I was going like, oh, my God. So we had Chase. Yeah, I mean, if anybody really wants to just, oh, my God, really, seriously. So tell us about Chase, and why was he so arrogant and difficult to work with Mason and Reese? And I do hope you're bringing them back. No, seriously.
Yes. So Chase is the type of guy who is kind of an expert in his field, which is underwater welding. It's considered one of the most dangerous jobs in the world, and he excels at it. So he's very arrogant, and he is frustrated that he has to put up with people questioning him, or I mean he believes, you know, I wasn't on the rig, I'm a contractor with the company, I don't actually work for the company, you know, you're trying to ask me questions I shouldn't have to answer. And he's just really kind of that jerky guy that, you know, knows he's good at his job, knows, you know, to a lot of women he's very good looking, and he just thinks it's a waste of his time to have Reese and Mason come out.
That's so rude. Now, why was you killed two? What happened with Max? You killed Max too.
I know.
It's not safe. Or it's not safe to be in this book, let me tell you.
Yeah, I know, and I felt that because I love Max, but I just felt there needed to be, with the impact, I just felt like somebody was not going to make it out of that crash.
I know,
and
I felt bad.
Yeah, I did too. So that was a little hard, but I knew that was going to, fairly quickly into writing the draft, I knew that was going to happen, that scene was going to happen, and I did play with it a little bit about who was the one that wasn't going to make it out, and I just decided the pilot would be the one kind of, I guess, closest, although there was somebody else in the other front seat, but the way that the windshield exploded and all that came in, it basically jarred Max out of the helicopter.
That must have really been painful. I know.
Yeah.
You don't want to know. So tell us about Jason and Brad, and tell us why Textual Oil seemed to be involved in rescuing these people. Notice I said seemed people.
Yes. So Jason and Brad are Coast Guard. They're rescue divers. They came out to rescue them. Textual Oil is the company that owns the oil rig that wants to get it back on production schedule. And so the quicker they can get them on the rig, then the quicker things can get back to running regularly. So really Textual Oil's main concern is not about, honestly, about the people that the guys that perished, or, you know, out of really kindness and compassion. It was more they want to get back to business. And the sooner they can get things going, they can get back to regular business.
Everything lately is about business and money. It's really sad.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth.
It is.
Everything. And everything has gone up. Every service that you have, the simplest thing has gone up. Even chicken salad and tuna. Everything has gone up.
It has. No, that's true. It's absolutely true. Like it's a silly story, but my husband and I were traveling from a trip to the beach, and there wasn't a Starbucks around, and I wanted a coffee, and so we stopped at Dunkin' to get a coffee, and it had some like espresso shots in it, kind of like an Americano, and it was over $5, and I'm like, at Dunkin', I was like, what happened there? And he's like, because it used to be two something. He's like, nope, it went up, everything's going up. So I agree with you there. It is very sad and frustrating.
I know. A pound of chicken salad used to be like $7. Now it's 20 in some places.
Are you kidding?
No, I went yesterday. Chef Maria makes it special for me for whatever reason. And she made me 2 pounds. I only wanted one, and it was like $20. And I said, this is too much money and too many pounds. I don't need 2 pounds of chicken salad. Yeah, everything is like, forget it. So we've got the
menu. It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary. We've got Carl and his wallet medic on the Dauntless. I like this guy.
Yeah.
How did you create him? Because Reese and Mason didn't want him to check him out, but they had no choice. So tell us about him.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you brought in Brooke. We'll get to her after. So how did Carl convince them they didn't have a choice? You got to get checked out because this is dangerous. You were in a crash.
Right. So Carl felt, and Noah, who Reese and Mason's boss, also felt that they needed to be checked out because they were just in a crash, and they needed, you know, sometimes when you get done with something so strong, you have kind of that adrenaline rush, and when that starts to wear off, you can tell more where things are hurting or what's going on. And so Carl is... he's a good guy. He, you know, is not the most, let's say, you would say, super friendly and personable, but he's good at what he does, and he's compassionate in when people have injuries. But he wants to make sure he does his job well, and so, you know, he tells them he needs to have a look at him, and it kind of goes from there. But Carl, in my mind, basically has worked in that kind of field for years and years. I think he started out as a medic in the military and then when his enlistment was up, he pulled out and, you know, went to medical school. And then started working on oil rigs. He wanted to travel and knew that, you know, he could work on a set rig for a time and then, you know, maybe move to a different one, a different area of the world. But he's been with the Dauntless since they started. And he's quite good at what he does. He's not, you know, top-notch, but he's good at what he does.
Well, there are a lot of medical professionals lately that are not as good as they used to be, and not as concerned as they used to be. Yeah, everything basically now is very few doctors see patients. Some of them do, and everything is basically telehealth.
It is. It is absolutely. And I have some chronic health issues, and so I do have to say the majority of the doctors I work with are very, very good. But it took me a while to find them. Even with, you know, chronic health stuff, for the majority of it, they still are doing telehealth. So unless you need a test or something. Yeah. So I think telehealth is fine if it's just a checkup, like, hey, how are you? I'm good. Everything feeling okay? Yes. But if you've got something going on, you really want to be seen by the doctor. You know, they can't check your throat if it's sore, or, you know, those type of things if you can't see them in person.
I know my ENT and allergy doctor claims he could do that, but I don't think so. And basically, wait till you see I went for a telehealth the other day for something, just a general question that I had. That telehealth phone call is going to cost $400 to my insurance company. That's how much it costs. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
They don't get that much, but yeah, Some of them are $300, some of them are $400. They charge you like a regular visit. I am so good with this. You have no idea. It's scary. So
we have
a love issue going here.
Yes.
Poor Caleb. He does not like Mason. Not at all. Why?
No. Well, he's kind of
him.
He's no
poor guy.
Yeah. He's known Reese quite a while. And over the last month or two before the story, he started to have feelings for her, beyond that, a friendship or a coworker. And Reese likes him very much as a friend, but does not feel the same way. And she doesn't do anything to lead him on or make him think that. But when Mason comes in and he kind of sees that attraction plus tension plus, you know, all these raw emotions between the two of them, he kind of knows from the start, like, this is not going to be a good thing. And his personality is very regimented, very by the books, very, you know, and Mason's very good at what he does, but he tends to push things kind of to the edge, not endangering anybody else other than himself sometimes, but Caleb feels like he's too reckless for Reese to be with.
Well, we're going to have to get him a girlfriend if you bring him back somehow. We'll have to figure that one out.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now there's two ships. There's the Dauntless, and we have to talk about the Freedom. What was the role of the crew of the Freedom? I wasn't so sure about them. And tell us who Gwyneth Lansing is, and how does she play a major role on the Freedom, which is the other ship, people, in case you don't know.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Okay, so the other ship, supposedly, the way it's set up is that they are a marine research ship in one sense. So they have a lot of different scientists that are out there that are studying, you know, the sea life in the area, the effect of the oil rig being in the area, and they're also pretty staunch in environmental, wanting to protect the environment for marine life. And Gwyneth Lansing is basically the head of that ship and of that particular program within the environmental group called the Freedom Group as well.
Okay, where am I here? Now, we entered the Dauntless and we meet Ed Scott. What is his role and how does he defend himself? We can't forget about Ed. And the interesting part is, why did you include the diary? That was interesting.
Thanks. Okay, so Ed is basically the guy in charge of the Dauntless during his crew's shift, and he would kind of be basically like a foreman or a like if they were a manufacturing plant, he'd be plant manager. So he's basically the head of the rig. And he answers, he's kind of the middle guy. He answers between corporate and his workers. So, for example, if there's a problem with one of the workers and, you know, corporate is not working well with them, he tries to kind of fill that middle ground. And the crew safety really falls under him because it's really kind of his rig. I just pictured him there kind of from the start. He kind of came to mind pretty quickly. And I don't know why, but I kind of pictured a little bit younger Ed Harris in the role. So kind of what I had in mind. Yeah, I'm pretty much a visual writer. So I, you know, always have to have kind of character images in my mind and, you know, what they look like. And it'll change as I write the book. But, yeah, I kind of picture them kind of this, you know, strong work ethic, you know, trying to keep peace between corporate and the rig and also trying to keep the rig safe as possible. So he takes the death very hard because he feels like something wasn't working right. And until, you know, it's proven there was foul play involved, he feels like he let his, you know, team down. And then when they find out it was foul play, then, you know, things shift differently. And the diary, yeah, I just decided I thought it would be a neat way to show Reese's feelings and kind of who she was at that time and bring it forward. And I debated about doing it a little further in the novel, a little bit more, but I didn't want to overdo it and I didn't want to distract too much from kind of the other scenes going on.
Yeah, I know. You know, people review books like me, and they don't always appreciate the greatness of people that write. So sometimes they say, well, you know, this is too over. Tell me about it. You never know what someone's going to write. As a matter of fact, on my last tour with Partners in Crime, Silent Voices, one person at the end wrote the most nastiest possible review she could possibly find on my stories.
It was
so horrific that I just said, thank you very much for not understanding what I wrote. I write from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. So the people I'm writing about are dead. So they're telling their stories. And one story that she thought it was the one story she hated, I probably should have written it from the point of view of the student, except I was a student. I was writing it from the point of view of my sixth grade teacher, who was horrible. There was a true story. Everything I wrote was true.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, she's horrible.
Wow.
So she wrote the most nastiest possible thing. I said, obviously, you don't quite get what I wrote. And my sixth grade teacher,
right.
Well, what can I say? So, yeah.
Right.
So, now, what I found interesting is, my next book is going to come out, I hope. Well, my next book came out already. It's called What If? What if you lived in a world that I created? Would you realize that you should wear a mask in the one that you're in? It's eight Twilight Zone stories. I don't know why I wrote it. I just wrote it. So I'm going to write another one. It's going to be called What's Next? Faces Behind the Masks, Alive and Dead.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't
know why. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, if you're excited about writing it, that's what you should do. You know, if that's
eventually. First, I have to, my shows and my reviews come first. What can I say? So, three things. You must have done research for this too. What are three things needed for guests to ignite and why? So people actually don't do this because you never know. I mean, there were fires the other day out of nowhere. Everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, explosions, and then they had that explosion with toxic whatever in one of the that was scary. Out of nowhere the whole thing blew up. So what do they need to for gas to ignite and how do you prevent that? That's scary.
Right. Yeah. So what I looked up was and I asked my husband because he had been in the military and he had been on subs, and so fire prevention on a sub is pretty important too. He helped a little bit with this, but they kind of call it a triangle, and it needs oxygen, heat, like for example, like a lighter or a match or something that would produce kind of almost like an ignition for it, and then the fuel, so whether it's gasoline or like gas vapors or anything like that. So if you have, you know, like your gas stove is leaking and obviously oxygen's in the air, if somebody would light a cigarette in there, it could blow everything up because those are the three things you need to start a fire. So, I mean, the best thing to do is if you know there, if you smell gas, if you are near some place that's with something flammable, if you're in an area that could go up very easily, like the woods, you know, don't smoke, or, you know, make sure that the, you know, butts are put in like a bucket of water, or because it's easy enough for that to catch fire and then it spreads and then it's horrible trying to fight it. So luckily
like these wildfires that they can't seem to contain. And there's another one this morning that's horrible.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, is it? I didn't see this morning's jet. Is it out in California or?
Yeah, California.
Yeah.
And then there was one in Australia recently also.
That oh, my
like,
goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely. And I think a lot of times they find out they're not obviously, you know, natural by any means. They're, you know, a cigarette-less
no,
bike camper. Yeah, it's just, it's so sad. And then that camper is risking the devastation of the forest, but also all the lives of the firefighters who were working to put it out and to contain it. So
I know, it's scary. Well, this part of the book really scared me, the curse. How did you create the curse and the fear of the crew of the Dauntless? I go, this was so cool. They were really scared, too, this curse.
Thank you. It's up more by the Outer Banks, but they have what's called the Graveyard of the Atlantic, and it's a bunch of sunken ships. You can actually go diving down there and see all these ships because the tide would come in and it was too shallow for them. And I was like, you know, that would be really cool if, you know, I had a ship that sunk, and if the ship that sunk had a curse. I just honestly, I don't know where the curse part came from, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of developed on its own. And I just thought it was kind of a fun, almost fun bit of history. I mean, it didn't historically happen, but in my mind, you know, it was bringing something from the past into the future and showing kind of how sometimes when there's something like that, that the idea of it or the superstition about it can make things appear to be part of it. You know, if they see something go wrong, instead of trying to figure out why it went wrong, and they can very easily say it was a curse. And, you know, a lot of sailors have very deep respect for the ocean, but they also, you know, will pay ear to, you know, some superstitions or some, you know, treasure type of thing. You know, they have all different kinds of stories. And so I kind of pulled from that and thought that that would be a good way for the crew to be keeping their focus in that direction.
Well, we have two other, we have a lot of people in this book, people on both sides. So things get more complicated when Noah has to deal with cases about the Dauntless and Brooke. So how does she come into that?
Right. So Brooke is a flight medic with the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes home and finds her house has been broken into. She is very good friends with Noah's sister. Her name's Gabby. And she automatically calls her friend, and Gabby's boyfriend, Finn, is the crime scene investigator on the team, and they come in, and Finn kind of works up the house to see if there's anything he can find. Brooke has just gotten out of a bad relationship, and there's a restraining order in place, but, you know, Gabby's worried it is her ex, and, you know, how's she going to be? And they're going to be out of town. And so Gabby naturally calls her brother and asks him if he would keep an eye kind of on Brooke and follow the case. Because if the case involves a Coast Guard team member, then that falls under their jurisdiction. And so he comes out to try to figure out, you know, who's causing this. Is she going to be safe in between, you know, until they figure out exactly who's doing it. And Noah kind of takes a personal interest because his sister is such good friends with Brooke, and he knows Brooke does such a good job in the Coast Guard itself. He has a lot of respect for the job she does because it's not an easy one either.
Now we have a character that I was very suspect of, because that was me trying not to trust this guy. That's Lucas and his relationship to Caleb. Why did he take the job on the Dauntless? We won't say why. The last word of my question I left out. Why did he take the job on the Dauntless? I didn't like this guy.
I know, I did not like this guy either.
Good, so I'm not wrong. Okay, good.
No, I did not like him either. So, yeah, I don't want to give too much away about it, but it was not with the best of intentions that he joined the crew, and he kind of had ulterior motives for being on it. And it's pretty much a big gap between who Caleb is as a person and who his nephew is as a person. And, you know, Caleb is a very honest, loyal, hardworking, all those things, focused. Yeah, I do too. And Lucas is like the complete opposite, you know. I mean, he just kind of does what he wants to do. He lies like it's no big deal, you know, and he just, just the way he has no respect, even with Reese and Mason interviewing him, kind of expecting a favor to not have to be interviewed because he's Caleb's nephew. And yeah, he just is not a good guy.
No, he's not. And he expects everybody just to bow down to him. So sad.
Yes.
So
exactly.
Well, I had a feeling about this. I knew that the helicopter was meant to crash and that it might be linked to someone on the rig. So how did you create that? I mean, after being my own, whatever, I knew that it had to be something that somebody did something to it. So how did you create that? And, of course, that really sets the tone to everybody, don't go on a plane ever again or a helicopter.
Right. So the way to sabotage the helicopter, I asked my husband. He just kind of has a vast array of knowledge and different things. And so how to sabotage it was his idea. And then if that had happened and that had taken off, it would take a while for it to malfunction. So they would be far enough out that it would crash. But, yeah, I kind of gave them the scenario. I was like, okay, I want them this far out. I want it at night. I want this. And then he said, well, the easiest thing would probably be, you know, this rotary blade thing. And so he explained it and kind of what it would sound like when it first went wrong. So, my husband is actually a really big source of research for me, and if he doesn't know, he often has people he reaches out to who would know. So like the one of the oil rig guys was a brother of one of my husband's coworkers, so he's kind of got connections with a bunch of people just because of his job. And a lot of them will be like, oh yeah, my uncle does this or my aunt does that. Or the only time I've actually had to like put out emails to try to reach people for research or, you know, connect with them. Because my husband didn't have any expertise in this area and I didn't either, was for an older book, I needed a forensic anthropologist. And I reached out, and there was a very kind one who teaches at Eastern Michigan University, and she was a huge help. She literally like walked me through everything she would do if she came upon a scene the way I described it. And so, you know, having, I think, beyond the books or beyond online, if you can connect with an expert and at least even one in that particular area, it can just, you get to know some of the little things that you wouldn't know otherwise.
That's lucky, because it's very hard to find anybody. I mean, if I need something for computers, my husband is in computers, but basically I'm on my own. Really not.
I reached out
one time to a funeral director, but I might do that for the next one because I really want to get things straight about it. They said, well, you can go online and find this out. I said, but then I can, you know, put you as my, you know, advisor or whatever. That's so sad.
Yeah.
But
yes.
Yeah, we have Austin Kelly, and why does she seem to annoy and irritate Caleb? And I don't blame Racy; she doesn't like her either. Neither did I.
Right. Yeah. So Austin is a very driven young woman, and she is very focused on Gwyneth Lansing and a situation for a case where she's been hired by a gentleman's family. He was basically murdered or lost at sea and murdered. They found enough evidence of it. But she was hired by this man's wife to determine, well, and his brother, to determine what happened to him. And so Austin comes in and she's kind of like the person who would be like a really, really strong like DA or prosecutor, or, you know, if she'd gone that direction in law. But she likes to work her case, does not like interference, and kind of feels like when she goes in that Caleb and her just for some reason just bump heads, that they don't go about things the same way. He doesn't like her infringing on their case. She feels she has every right to, be given the circumstances, and so she's continuing to investigate this man who had started the Freedom Group. Death. And Caleb just feels like it's muddying waters and getting in their way.
So before I forget, I don't want to forget, Monday, Jeff Bond returns with Anarchy of Mice. And on the 26th, I was totally shocked and honored. New York Times author Ted Bell has agreed to do an interview. Actually, he asked for the interview for Dragonfire. And
wow.
That's great. Yeah,
that's
exciting.
Whoa.
Yeah, I was like, oh
yeah.
My God. And I
that's
wasn't
awesome.
Sure. And on September 3rd, Deb Pines will be there with Crooked Path, and she makes Jessica Fletcher, Mimi Goldman look. This character is great. On the 14th, and we can only pray that the book gets here, Dark Fear by Alan Jacobson, special time, 12 o'clock. 9/16, my favorite character, I love Jonathan Stride, Brian Freeman, who took over the Robert Ludlum series. Last week I interviewed him for the Born in Evolution, an exclusive for Funeral for a Friend. On the 22nd, All That Buried. And on the 24th, to end the month, None and Only, then Marilyn Levinson and Checked Out for Murder, her library mystery murder series. And that's just September. This show is booked until the middle of December, at which point, if no one has a book coming out or anything, I'm going to take the rest of the month off. But we'll see what happens.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah,
wow,
you
that
know.
Is a great lineup. That is really a great lineup.
Yes, and I was totally honored when I received an email from D.P. Lyle, who does Criminal Minds and Law and Order, who wrote for them.
Yes.
Two interviews in November. It's like, what? Yes.
Oh,
great.
That's great. Yeah, he is.
Yeah,
I've been
great.
To Raiders Police Academy, and
yeah.
He has, yeah, and I've been to Thriller Fest, and he has been at both, actually.
Yeah, I met him a few times.
Right.
I met him a few times, and yeah. I met him in person, and I'm so sorry that they didn't have Thriller Fest this year. And
yeah.
I was disappointed last year. My husband was ill, so we couldn't make it, but this year I would have definitely gone because I just wanted, you know, to see DP and Nelson DeMille, and actually it's fun because they walk in and they actually know who I am, which is really scary. Sorry.
Oh, that's great though. Yeah, I was
talking
about Thriller Fest.
It's great. Kim is great. So here's my next question.
Things
start to connect with Emmy and Logan, uncover information about two people and the possibility of greed, power, and control. How did you add that? And then why did you have someone put arsenic in the food of the crew? See, I was afraid to eat on there. I knew that was going to happen. I had a funny feeling somebody's going to do something evil.
Really?
That was good. Yeah, I get, you know what? I've read so many books, and yours is kind of different. And I said, okay, wait a minute. I'm waiting for the shock. I'm waiting for the surprise. They're having dinner, and I could tell something. I just felt that I wasn't going to eat that stuff. So how did you create something that with arsenic for the crew? That was really good. Poor people.
Thanks. Yeah, I just thought at that time the person that's involved wanted to continue to keep the focus on the curse and kind of they're looking at the curse. If the men are believing in the curse, if all this is going on, then they're not going to start looking at him. So I actually called my doctor and I said, I've been with her 20 years, so she's also a good friend in the sense of being my medical doctor. But I emailed her and I said, hey, I need it. She reads my books and I need to poison people's lunch, but I need to hit this quick and then it needs to heal this quick. And so she went and talked to several of her medical colleagues and came back and said arsenic was what they recommended. So that's what I went with.
Yeah, well, I needed something like that too, but I was lucky that my pharmacist was still there, so she helped me, and he helped me.
Oh, that's great.
But
yeah.
But Walgreens closed, so now I have to bother the other pharmacists there. And basically, you know, I haven't bothered them to do anything for that, but I might for the next one. As a matter of fact, I was aggravated because MD is a character in What If, and he's not going to get to read it because... Because Walgreens. I'm so aggravated. You have no idea because Walgreens really was the greatest. And the corporate office said that they didn't really care. They didn't want to pay the rent anymore. So we were left hanging. And thank God for Rite Aid and my people there. But it's sad. So
it is that.
What happens? Yeah, Chase. What happens to Chase? And what would destroy the evidence? Because they didn't want anybody to really know what happened. Or did they? They didn't really.
Yes. No, they want them to think the story they tell is what happened. And so Chase is killed and basically the evidence would be destroyed if the body was not kept at a cool enough temperature because evidence would begin to fade. So they had to find a way to get the freezer where his body was being kept, the auxiliary freezer, to not have any power, to kind of turn the lights off, to turn the power, just run the basics, because they wanted to not preserve the body, even though Mason and Reese are trying to preserve the body, because they know that if it is taken by the ME and it's been preserved, that it could, if the right amount of autopsy is done, it could prove that it was not an accident.
Yeah, that would not be good. So
no.
The ending will make you shiver and scared. Promise you that. The ending is shocking, and the reasons for each murder is different. How did you create different motives for each murder? Because most people create like one, maybe two. There's a whole bunch of motives. How did you create each one of them? And they're all believable, by the way. It's not like, oh, my God.
Thank you.
It's not like the book I read. I read one last week, and I won't tell you. It takes me a book of like 400-500 pages could take me 2 hours to read it if it's good.
Oh,
I'm serious.
Wow.
The book
That's
that
amazing.
I just finished, I won't say what it is. It took me 4 weeks because I stared at it for a while. I finished it yesterday. I was like, you actually finished it, but some of the events were so over the top that could not have happened. No way.
That's
how
a
did
shame.
You create it with so many motives that?
Yeah.
And they're believable.
Yeah.
How did you do that? That's amazing.
Oh, thank you. I'm not really sure how I pick a motive in the beginning. I don't do a lot of plotting. I will kind of brainstorm some ideas, and I just sit down and write the first draft. So a lot of times things will just kind of come up as I'm writing it, and then sometimes I'll have to stop and think, ooh, well, if that person actually did this, why would they be doing it? But a lot of it just kind of comes as I'm writing the book, the first draft. And then when I go to do the second draft, that's where I try to really hone in and go, okay, does this make sense? Would somebody really do this? And is this the right timing? And we kind of joke around our house. My kids are grown now, but we kind of joke that FBI is going to show up one day because I'm, like, researching all this funky stuff on the computer. And, you know, we'll have a thing and I'll ask my husband something like, you know, about a fire or about, you know, if you were in this cage or, you know, all this stuff. And my younger daughter is finishing up her last year of college, and she's at home doing it virtual. And she'll be like, yeah, the talks we have in our house are not like other people's houses. And I said, well, you did it when you weren't little kids. So, Yeah, you know, my mind seems to kind of go that way sometimes. So it's good for books. It's probably not the best thing to be talking about, depending on the company. But, you know, even my dad has a lot of background information and just really is really helpful with research in certain areas. And I had met him for a cup of coffee, and we were sitting there and we were talking through how something like this from a different book would happen. And we got up to leave, and the guy at the table behind us looked horrified. Like, he was like, I said, no, 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 it's for a book. And he was like, okay. So, yeah, it's just for me, like, kind of just when I get to a certain point in a book, like, talking about it and, like, starting to visualize it and all of that is really an exciting part for me. I love coming up with ideas as I'm writing that first draft.
That is great. The only thing, my niece just became an RN, so if I need medical advice, I just say nurse. I helped her through it. I'm not a medical person. I'm an educator, and I worked in the school for all those years. So, but she went to nursing school, and her aunt went with her for 4 years. I read the book, did the articles, helped her with her case study. I learned a lot, and then I had and a few of my nurse practitioners or whatever that would help me. And I'd call them and go, like, it's me again. This is what I need. Are you busy? And they would help me. So, I learned a lot. So if I need to know something, I just ask Danny. Her name is Danny, D-A-N-I.
Good.
She's my medic. Yeah, Danny Nick. She's a riot, and she's so cute. But where do you see Reese and Mason next in the series, and who else is coming back? And, of course, you got to bring Caleb back to create more problems for them, too, because that makes me feel much better.
Yes. So the whole team will be back. Who the primary characters are and the secondary characters, definitely not going to mention who the secondary characters are because I want it to be a surprise, but the main romantic characters are going to be Noah and Brooke. There's going to be a lot of kind of unraveling of, like, their past or why they struggle or, you know, why. I'm working on that now, and I'm excited about the story. I think it'll come together hopefully well and be a good end of the series.
Are you going to do another tour with Cheryl and Partners in Crime? I promised her I would ask. She had to take care of something this morning, otherwise she'd be listening. But she'll be listening later because she critiques all my shows. She tells me I'm wonderful. No, really, they listen to everything.
She's so sweet. Yeah, no, I'm absolutely going to go with them again. They literally, like, she emailed me and I said, okay, I'll read over this and get back with a review tomorrow, but please know you did an amazing job. She was fabulous. They're so organized. They're so fun to work with. They do an amazing job. So, yes, I definitely plan to work with them again.
Oh, well, that's why I'm doing mine October for What If. They are.
Are you?
And there's another. Yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm doing one with them for What If. And I only have 10 people so far, but it's better than none. Most people won't understand what I wrote, whatever. And I also did one, and they're really inexpensive, but because I don't review for them because they only have digital, but because I post stuff for them, RABT Rabbit Tours, it's just virtual tours, but they set up something for me that I didn't even expect. August 13th, they gave me a virtual blitz, and like 30 people posted stuff and spotlighted my book, which I thought that was great. I didn't even know about that one. And then September 7th, I start the tour. I just hope I get more people on the tour to do it. But basically, because I review for them and I do stuff for them, they didn't charge me the whole price. They charged me something, but not a lot, which made me
happy.
Wow,
that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah,
so
they're a really great team.
I think that people can learn a lot about fire prevention reading this book. So where can we learn more about you and your work? And I do hope when you write the next book that I get it, because I need to know what happens
Absolutely.
Next.
Absolutely. So I my website is just my name, DannyPetrie.com, and it has information on all my books. And you can click on the book, and it'll go in deeper detail about that book, and it has some fun extras like character dossiers and, you know, some videos of some stuff. And also, I'm very active on my Facebook author account.
Oh, good.
I'm pretty much on there daily. Yep. And I'm also on Instagram. So, but I'd say primarily right now on Facebook. I do get on Instagram as well, but I have such a really good community on Facebook that I really enjoy it. So, and then I have a newsletter list where I talk about future books and I do recommended reads and just a wide variety of stuff in it. I do, and there's a slot to sign up for that on my website.
Well, your review is on Amazon with 5 stars.
Oh, thank you. That's wonderful.
I haven't been giving 5 stars.
So
it's like I didn't even have to think about this one. I was like,
thank you so much.
I literally did not have to think about this one. It's on my Facebook wall. It's on LinkedIn because I'm very popular there, and on Twitter, it's everywhere. But it's on. I got the confirmation this morning. I put it on. It's amazing. So either Amazon takes 5 hours or it takes 5 days, and this one took 3 seconds. They just approved it. So it's there with 5 stars. It made me feel so much better because I was getting worried that they didn't love me anymore, but they do, I guess.
Okay.
And I guess you never know. It's right here. Yes, it is. It's right there. I got it. And, you know, they send you either a confirmation or they come up with some whatever story. I don't even listen to them anymore. But I want to thank you so much. It's not very nice outside here today. It's 70 degrees and it's raining. But you do pour some sunshine, and this has been great. Thank you so much. Do you do panel shows, by the way? I do panels.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
yep.
I'm doing one that's really weird. I'm doing two on timelines and using ancestors from the past with a person that's similar to the one in the present. But I want to do maybe one more. I have to get your email from Cheryl. I want to do maybe one more. In December, right after the 8th, and then I'm going to take the month off. I keep saying that, but they're not going to let me do it. But we'll see what happens. But thank you so much, Danny.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Bye.